Court will proceed to the Timonero versus Astru case. Mr. Weber.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. My name is George Weber, and I'm here on behalf of the plaintiff appellant in this case, Janine Timonero. In this Social Security appeal, the ALJ awarded a period of disability, a closed period of disability, but he ended the disability in January of 2008. It was awarded from January of 2004 to January of 2008. Is the contention of Timonero that the administrative judge did not properly use the medical improvement standard in ending the period of disability. The judge and the magistrate judge both said that Timonero herself at the administrative hearing testified to medical improvement. A review of the record showed that she did not testify to medical improvement. In fact, she testified to ongoing symptoms, medical treatment, including narcotic pain medication taking, such as OxyContin. When the administrative law judge found the medical improvement, summarily in finding 12 of the ALJ decision, the ALJ mentioned the improvement due to her testimony and also a return to some work activity. The judge never made a finding in ending the disability on an exception to medical improvement due to performance of substantial gainful activity. It appears that focusing that the claimant testified to medical improvement and then had returned to work is not fully complying with the regulation, which says that a reduction in medical severity must be based on improvement in symptoms, signs, or laboratory findings, as stated in the brief. The issue of whether a trial work period would apply would come into play secondarily. If the ALJ analysis was flawed in finding that the disability ended, then whether or not there was SGA and to the extent there was, whether it precluded ongoing payment of benefits as an exception to medical improvement should have been undertaken, and that wasn't done. Here it appears that it was kind of chopped, the statement of the testimony claiming that Timonero testified to medical improvement when in fact she didn't, and then citing the return to work without analyzing it showed that the period of disability was not properly ended. The government raised the issue of waiver of argument in their brief because the claimant of the Timonero did not file an objection to the recommended report of the recommended decision of the magistrate judge within the proper time period, and it never filed an objection, which is in fact the case. There were a couple cases that allowed that to pass. The cases go both ways on that. In this case, there was no explicit statement by the magistrate judge on the recommended decision that failing to object would result in a potential waiver of any argument to this court. Whether or not that case, I can see that issue has been decided both ways in this court itself. So, in conclusion, I would say that The judge found Tumanaro disabled, but he did not properly end the disability, and we would ask that the claim be remanded for consideration of when the disability ended.
Thank you, Mr. Weber. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Joshua Danke, and I represent the Commissioner of Social Security. Appellant's claims in this case should be rejected on two grounds. First, appellant's failure to object to the magistrate judge's report and recommendation amounts to a forfeiture of her appeal rights. And second, even if the Court does find that the appeal rights were not forfeited, substantial evidence does support the finding of the ALJ that appellant's disability ended after February 1, 2008. Now, first, appellant forfeited her appeal rights by failing to object to the magistrate judge's report and recommendation. The well-settled rule in the circuit is that failure to object to a report and recommendation waives the right to appeal the recommendation as well as the district court's adoption of it. In the Provident Bank case, this court did instruct, through its supervisory power, did instruct magistrate judges to include a warning that failure to object on time would waive the right to appeal. But in that case, this court did not address the question of whether application of this waiver rule would, without an explicit warning, would still be proper or appropriate. And we would argue that it would be appropriate in this case. Here, unlike the other cases we found it on which appellant now relies in her reply brief, appellant was advised of a definite time limit to file objections. And appellant filed nothing before or after the deadline and still has offered no explanation as to why not. Moreover, this waiver rule has been in effect for over two decades. Parties who are informed that they have a specific number of days in which to file objections or do something else should reasonably anticipate that there are consequences for failing to file objections on time or certainly to file at all.
The case law doesn't follow that, though, as I understand it. The case law, some of the case law, says you got to tell them if they don't object, they'll lose their rights, right?
Yes, Your Honor. It does say that. It does not necessarily say that failure of the magistrate judge to provide this warning necessarily amounts to no application of the rule. And we would argue in this case that it would be appropriate to apply the waiver rule for several reasons, and none of these reasons which appellant says are not true. First, that the magistrate judge did say 14 days to file. And we would argue that there would be that parties would understand that there would be repercussions to not filing that. A good example of this in another context, the district court's order in this case adopting the magistrate judge's report and recommendation did not include a warning that failure to appeal within 60 days would waive appeal rights, yet appellant did timely file her appeal. And then other facts in this case, not just the fact that there was a magistrate judge deadline set, but appellant not only did not object on time, but did not object late, did not ask the district court to reconsider its opinion after the fact, even when the district court said in its order that appellant did not object on time or at all. And to this day, appellant has not offered an explanation for this, and appellant has not contested the fact that she knew that there would be consequences for failing to object. So we would ask the court to exercise its discretion in dismissing her appeal because the appellant did forfeit her appeal rights in that manner. Now, even if the court does determine that appellant did not forfeit her right to appeal, appellant's arguments should be rejected because substantial evidence does support the ALJ's finding of non-disability starting on February 2, 2008. And just a small point, I believe appellant's counsel stated that the disability ended in January 2008, but in fact, the last day of disability was February 1st, 2008, so non-disability started on February 2nd. Now, the ALJ did find that appellant's disability ended on this date because she had resumed full-time work and had experienced medical improvement related to her ability to work, as was demonstrated by both the record, the medical record, and the testimony of appellant. Now, appellant does argue that the ALJ should have given greater consideration to whether she had completed a trial work period. However, the Social Security regulations do provide that any trial work period ends if and when a claimant experiences sufficient medical improvement, regardless of whether the 9 months of trial work period have ended, and therefore also regardless of whether the ALJ included any analysis of a trial work period in his decision.
What part of the medical records show medical improvement that would end the disability?
Well, Your Honor, in some of the treatment notes, starting in February 2008 and moving forward, there was a February 2008 treatment note from Dr. Wilson noting that plaintiff had experienced good relief from a previous injection. In June 2008, Dr. Wilson again noted that recent injections had provided her with 80% pain relief.
Yeah, 80%, but she was reporting her pain at 9 and 10 and I think even 11 at one point on a scale of 10.
Sure, and Your Honor, and Dr. Wilson's notes, however, reflect that these are her subjective complaints, and his notes are otherwise demonstrate not only a strong improvement from medication, but also strong daily activities, ability to perform daily activities, improving on medication as well in several of those notes. And in fact, the only evidence that appellant seems to cite to in supporting her argument is this June 2008 note showing ongoing treatment, but of course ongoing treatment does not disprove medical improvement. And in fact, this June 2008 note is it's also the same point at which Dr. Wilson noted 80% improvement. And then appellant cites to the August 2008 note in which, again, appellant subjectively complained of severe pain, but Dr. Wilson noted an improvement in daily activities on medication. And therefore, appellant cannot refute what the overall medical record does say about her improvement. And with respect to appellant's testimony, she claims that she did not admit to improvement during the hearing, contrary to the ALJ's finding. Now, appellant actually contradicted herself during the hearing. She did at one point claim no improvement since January 2004, but then at other points during the hearing, she admitted numerous facts that lead to the conclusion that she did, in fact, experience medical improvement. For one, she admitted that her injections helped her. Two, she admitted that around the time of her surgeries in January 2004 and July 2005, she needed help taking care of herself and her home. But that when she recovered, she no longer needed help in those respects. That, we argue, indicates improvement. Third, she admitted to full-time work starting in February 2008 and additional part-time work on top of that shortly thereafter, which we would argue, since she claimed she could not work beforehand because of her impairments, indicates medical improvement. And fourth, she stated that she was unable to drive as of starting in 2003 due to her impairments. But then she, during the hearing, she testified that she was able to resume driving in June 2006. So these facts are more than enough for the ALJ to reasonably conclude that appellant's own testimony supported a finding of medical improvement. And the ALJ therefore recently found that both appellant's testimony and the medical record supported finding medical improvement as of February 2, 2008. Now, briefly revisiting appellant's argument with respect to a trial work period, appellant still does not explain how further consideration of her trial work activity in general would have led to any different outcome. As explained, it does make no difference in this case because of medical improvement. Beyond that, however, Social Security regulations provide that a trial work period is a period of time in which a claimant may test her ability to work and still potentially be considered disabled. The intended purpose for allowing a trial work period is not to allow someone to work more than full time, clearly beyond the tested ability to work, show significant medical improvement, and still also collect disability benefits, which seems to be what appellant is asking for here. Now, to this day, despite alleging error in the ALJ's decision, appellant has not specified when she believes her own supposed trial work period should have ended. Yet, she acknowledged in her brief to this court that she may very well have exhausted the trial work period. During the administrative hearing, her counsel asked the ALJ to consider a closed period of disability ending at some apparently unknown point, due to her full-time work activity. And her records do show part-time work in 2005, 2006, 2007, and of course she admitted to full-time work starting February 2008, plus the additional work on top of that part-time as a construction flagger. And we would argue that appellant's silence regarding when she believes any applicable trial work period actually ended speaks volumes. She cannot show that she was reasonably entitled to disability benefits beyond February 2008, as evidenced by work and her medical improvement. Now, unless the court has any other questions for me, I will close by asking the court to reject appellant's arguments, as she did forfeit her appeal rights due to failing to object to the magistrate judge's report and recommendation. Alternatively, I would ask that the court affirm the district court's decision, as substantial evidence does support the ALJ's decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Denke. Mr. Weber?
I believe that everything was presented by both sides, and I'll answer any questions the court has. I have nothing further.
Apparently no more, Mr. Weber. We thank you, and we thank Mr. Demke, and the case is taken under advisement.